Good afternoon and welcome to your own health and fitness talk show. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. I'm here live with you every Tuesday at 2 talking to you about healthcare and fitness and taking your phone calls. Today's show is the first of two shows about the skin, how it reflects the state of our general health and how to protect it. Today I'll be interviewing the authors of The Life of the Skin, what it hides, what it reveals, and how it communicates. Doctors Loretta Pratt Balin, M.D., and her husband, Arthur Balin, M.D., Ph.D. Now, I have a lot to cover in the show. There's an awful lot of material here, so I'm going to forego my usual editorial and get right into our interview. I do want to remind those of you who may want to get a tape of today's show, or if you need to get hold of me during the week, you can call me during normal business hours at 707-769-1458, and I'll give that number out again at the end of the show. Now, I know that we have Dr. Arthur Balin with us now. Is that right? Are you there, Arthur? Arthur, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. So let me start by introducing the two of you, and then, as I understand it, Loretta, your wife, may be joining us after a few minutes. Either that or we'll just go ahead and interview you alone. Either way is fine. But in any case, Arthur Balin, M.D. and Ph.D. is one of the foremost dermatologists and gerontologists in the country. Trained at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, he has held academic appointments at Yale, New Haven Hospital, Cornell University, Medical College, the Rockefeller University, and Baylor University Medical Center. He's board certified in 6 medical specialties. This is a busy person. In his medical practice in Media, Pennsylvania, he focuses on treatment for skin cancer, wound healing, and the problems of aging skin. Now, he wrote this book in conjunction with his wife, Loretta Pratt Balin, who is an MD, and a graduate of Barnard College and the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. She's a fellow in investigative dermatology at the Rockefeller University, and in her joint practice with Dr. Arthur Balin, she specializes in cosmetic dermatology and women's skin problems. In addition, not with us today, but a contributor to the book was Moretta Whittlesley, I believe is the way you pronounce her name. And she's a freelance writer specializing in medical topics. And I must say, she did a good job at making this book a very pleasant read. Although I hear the voice of the two of you in the book does read like a novel, so it's very entertaining. I think that what I'd like to do, Dr. Balin, is start out by talking about some of the things that I would call maybe myths about the skin, things that people believe, and I think that I was guilty of this as well, that may not be so. And I'll start with the least frightening myth, which is the idea that since the upper layer of the epidermis is not considered to be live tissue, that it is sort of dead. And what you've mentioned early on in the book is that it's not only the first, it's our immune system's first line of defense, but it is also a sense organ and has on it hairs that we don't even see that pick up sensitive things, like even changes in airflow and stuff.
That's right. The skin is not just the sausage casing. It represents our interface between the external world and the internal environment. You know, the skin is a sexual organ, it's a receptor organ and an expressive organ. It regulates our heat through sweating and evaporation. It's the first line of defense in our immune system. It processes the external world and presents it to our internal world.
Another myth would be that people of different color are intrinsically different. And what you have explained is that when you are a surgeon and a dermatologist, you have seen people underneath the epidermis, and we are in fact the same color underneath.
We certainly are, and in fact, it goes more than that. A pigment is made by melanocytes, or the pigment cells, and we all have the same number of pigment cells. It's just that people that are black, their pigment cells are more efficient and are making melanin, whereas people that are very fair, they still have the same amount of pigment cells. They're just not making melanin.
Yeah, and as we'll find out later, things can go awry with those cells that produce melanin. But essentially, what we're saying is that people whose skin, like Hispanic skin and African skin and East Indian skin, is in fact better able to tolerate sun exposure. because of the melanin. All right. So, but then can we say that dark skin is immune to skin cancer?
No, but okay. But black skin has a sun protection factor of about 12.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's pretty good at protection. But I have had patients who are black who have had skin cancer.
Well, and of course, there are many shades of dark skin. There are many shades of African skin and Hispanic skin. And what about Asiatic skin? Is it more pigmented and more protected or not?
Well, it is somewhat more protected. When one is doing cosmetic surgery on Asiatic skin, it's difficult. It's actually easier to operate on people that are very white or people that are very black, because people that are medium color, Indian skin or Asiatic
Hispanic.
Skin,
mm-hmm.
they can hyperpigment or hypopigment after cosmetic procedures.
Mm.
So it's actually trickier to operate on them.
Okay, so from the point of view of operating them on them, but from what about from sun exposure? Are they
sun exposure, they have more protection than an Irish fair white skin.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, here's the big myth. Here's the most disturbing myth, which is that, you know, you talk about it in the book, but, you know, I'm very health conscious. And I still have been under the impression that exposure to the sun is health promoting, that it stimulates immunity in small amounts, not in huge amounts, but that it because it helps with the synthesis of vitamin D, it helps our bones to be strong, and that people who are prone to different kinds of illnesses feel better when they have a little bit of sun on their body. And so, you know, the idea is the sun is natural and healthy. And what you're saying in the book is, not really. And in fact, you even go so far to say that it can, in fact, damage the immune system by destroying T cells. Well, this is very confusing for people to understand. So why don't you try to explain to us why? I mean, we keep thinking, gosh, natural man, you know, in nature, we were out in the sun. So what's up with this? Is it because we're so many of us Northern Europeans living in areas where we're exposed to more sun than we would have genetically? Or what's happening here?
Well, you know, everything in life is a balance. And a person can exercise too little, and they can exercise too much.
And how?
And it's the same thing with sun. And some sun, I mean, sun makes you feel good. It does cause vitamin D to be formed, but it has some detrimental effects. Specifically with regard to the immune system, it's been a very recently discovered story as to how sunlight interacts with the immune system. And it turns out that when an antigen is first presented to the body, it's presented through the skin. And for example, suppose you just imagine poison ivy. Suppose nobody, a person had never been exposed to poison ivy before, and now they get poison ivy on their skin. That antigen is presented to the Langerhans cells, and which are cells of the immune system. And then from those cells, it's presented to T helper cells.
Mm-hmm.
And the T helper cells then cause a delayed hypersensitivity reaction or an allergic type reaction to that antigen. If a person were to experience sun exposure before a novel antigen, a new antigen like that poison ivy was presented to the body, what the sun exposure does is it kills the T helper cells.
Right.
And so now when the antigen is presented, it's presented to T suppressor cells because that's all that's left. And so what will happen is a person will become tolerant to that antigen and will never react to it again. And that's actually a very interesting phenomenon because experimentally scientists are trying to figure out whether that could be useful in organ transplantation, for example. Maybe there's some way of giving people a dose of light and presenting a kidney to them so that they won't reject that kidney.
Yeah, because if I understand what you just said, you know, on first hearing it, you think, well, that's good. I don't want to get poison oak. I mean, that's fine. I don't want to be sensitive to that. But what you're saying is that it's suppressing the body's ability to recognize an invader intelligently. It's confusing the immune system.
Yes, basically. And that may be one of the reasons why there's a substantial amount of people, for example, that will get fever blisters after being on the beach. In other words, if their first exposure to herpes simplex or fever blisters is when they're on the after sun exposure, that may account for some of the risk occurrence of that. And that's just a temporary thing, because what happens is that those T helper cells are immediately replaced in the skin because they're circulating. So it doesn't, the sun doesn't destroy all of your T helper cells. What it does is destroys them in a local area where the sun was, and they only stay gone for a short amount of time before they're repopulated. But if an antigen is presented in that time, it gets presented by T suppressor cells.
In any case, what we're finding out is that there is this very powerful effect on the immune system from the skin. I mean, we know that things that are absorbed through the skin go into the bloodstream and things like that. We forget that the skin is a powerful, as you said, conduit. I mean, you even in the book said it's almost like it becomes almost like a metaphor for our relationship to the world. It's sort of the thing that shields us or doesn't. The part that's confusing for people is that we've all sort of thought, and I understand from your book, is going to depend on your skin type somewhat and the timing of your exposure to the sun and how you do it. But we all thought that if you had a small amount of tan, that it would protect you from skin cancer. But in fact, you know, in other words, what we've all believed, I think, up until now is, yes, if as a child, you know, before 18, you got repeated burnings, very serious burnings, that would leave you open for skin cancer. But that, in fact, having a little bit of a little toasty tone on your skin would protect you from skin cancer, and that appears not to be so. So why don't you explain something about the cumulative effects of the sun and the fact that even though damage before 18 is the most critical in terms of cancer, how it can continue to be critical as life goes on.
Sure. What we've learned about tan is that it's just when you cut yourself, you bleed. When the melanocytes are damaged by the sun, when the DNA in those cells is broken apart, they produce tan. They bleed tan. It's a response to injury.
Right, now, and that's something people don't understand, that it's a response to injury.
Exactly. Now, in fact, once you become tan, that does protect you against further damage, in other words, or at least helps to partially protect you. But the initial tan means the DNA is broken apart. It's a thymine dimer that occurs, and it causes the cells to produce pigment.
So are we saying then if you're a medium-complected person, not a very, very vulnerable person, someone who is extremely pale, if you're a person who actually does tan in the sun, is it then okay for you to maintain a little bit of exposure and have a little bit of a tan without roasting yourself?
Well, I would tell you that we tell our patients, I mean, you have to live, and we let people go and play golf and tennis and volleyball and everything else. We don't make people stay inside, but we say we don't go out with the purpose of getting a tan.
Mm-hmm. And also, I would think the timing of the exposure is critical as well. No, I mean, you know, farmers didn't go out in the middle of the hottest time of the day to do their farming. They timed it so that the sun was less intense.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So again, talking about the cumulative damage. For instance, people who begin to see age spotting on their skin are seeing, if I understand your book correctly, are seeing sun damage from when they were a child.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
But not only that, the entire electromagnetic spectrum impacts on our skin. When you cook a turkey in the oven and the skin browns, that's because of the infrared radiation, the heat. And that same process occurs to us. It's called non-enzymatic browning. And when you go out and lay on the beach, even if you have very good sunscreen on and you're protected against UVB and UVA, you're still getting infrared radiation and heat, and you're still causing damage to the skin and aging the skin just through that process. We'll cook just the same way that a turkey will cook.
So you're saying even with a good, strong sunscreen, that will happen to you?
Sure, because that's infrared radiation. That's not UVB or UVA, which is being blocked out. And in fact, in England, there's a condition called erythema abigni, which leads to skin cancers forming on the front of the shins of people that would spend a lot of time sitting in front of the fireplace.
Mm.
And it would just be the heat, the infrared radiation from the heat. Years of exposure to that would cause skin cancers.
Just briefly, for people who may be tuning in late, this is Your Own Health and Fitness on KPFA-FM. I'm Health Integration Specialist Elena Berman, and I'm speaking with author of The Life of the Skin, co-author, Dr. Arthur Balin, and we are talking about the effect of sun on our skin. Now, this is a bit frightening, what you've just said, because what you've just said sounds like a catch-22 situation. It sounds, and also I noticed that in the book, that people can get skin cancers even without being exposed to the sun, and even when they behave themselves and they cover themselves up and this and that. So, let me just say, I got a feeling from reading your book of what you suggest to your patients, which I think is pretty much trying not to be exposed to the sun. I mean, trying to wear long sleeve shirts and hats and covering your skin with sunscreen. But am I oversimplifying it? What do you want to say to our audience? Because a lot of people in California, this is not Southern California where it's very hot and intense all the time, but this is a place where people like to recreate by hiking and doing things like that. I think what I just heard you say is that the radiation from the sun is what's causing the cancer.
Well, no. In other words, what I said was that the entire electromagnetic spectrum interacts with our bodies, and each different portion of the spectrum may have a different degree of energy, so that, for example, the UVB rays, they will clearly lead to skin cancer with relatively small amounts of exposure. The UVA rays are promoters for cancer and also destroy the elastic tissue and cause the pigment to form, and they lead to aging of the skin. Infrared radiation also can cause damage, but it takes much more to cause damage. And what I tell people is, again, you have to be able to live. You just have to be sensible. The most important things are to cover up, to wear hats and sunglasses and long sleeve shirts and put on sunscreen and particularly to have a dermatologist and have your skin checked every year and be sure that spots aren't growing, because the sun is, that leads to really basal cell cancers and squamous cell cancers, but the most deadly form of skin cancer is melanoma, and that's when a mole goes bad, and that doesn't necessarily have to be related to sun exposure. That's more of a genetic condition.
Okay, that's interesting.
Dr. Pratt has joined us as well.
Hi there. Welcome to the show. We're still talking about the confusion about sun exposure, because I think that people, I was just saying to Arthur that it's confusing for people in California because we recreate outside, and we hike and swim outside and things like that. I think, again, just to try to put this to bed so we can move on a little bit, again, I think what's confusing for me and other people is if the primary time of vulnerability is from 0 to 18, and you've already done sort of the things that are going to cause your age spotting in middle age, that these are layers of stuff that's underneath here, there's a feeling of, well, gee, why don't I just go ahead and do things outside and I'll wear sunscreen, but I'm not going to worry about it because I already did it, the damage. But my understanding from reading the book is that that's not so.
That's right, and because cancer occurs by a process which is called first initiation, where the initial DNA damage occurs, and then something which is called promotion. Promotion is when the cells are stimulated to grow. So you could have a cell that's damaged, but it never grows, and nothing will happen to it. But if it's stimulated to grow and its DNA is broken apart, then it has a chance to become a cancer cell. And repeated exposures to UVA light, particularly, and that's the light in tanning booths, that's a promoter, and that will stimulate the skin to try to grow. And that's, even though the damage has been done many years ago, this promotion effect goes on throughout life.
Okay, and then there's also additional aging to the skin that occurs as well from continuing exposure, yes?
That's right.
Okay.
That's the destruction of the elastic tissue. And
that's the old luggage thing that happens to people, right? That's where
right.
we start to turn into, right, some kind of item of leather. Let's briefly move. I want to go back to aged skin and what can be done about that, but I want to also go over the other part of the book, which is very interesting, which is the fact that much of what you talk about in the book is the diagnosis of infectious disease process through things that occur on the skin that are often missed. And this was quite fascinating to read about, that you, I remember that Dr. Pratt, Loretta Pratt, saw, I think it was you that saw the slight lesion on this woman that had worked with you.
Yeah.
And realized that she'd been diagnosed with lung cancer, and in fact this wasn't a lung cancer, it was something related to cell division and skin. So she was misdiagnosed. This is something that occurs a lot, that the skin is the first sign. So what other things can people look for in skin? I mean, there's also the hormonal effects on the skin. There's any number of things that can happen. What are some of the things that people can be watching for?
Well, the story that we tell in the book is about a woman who had a condition called sarcoidosis, which not only affects the skin, but can also affect the lungs and the eye and the kidney. And the person in the story had one discrete lesion on her skin, which really was the clue to what was happening internally. And other internal conditions do reflect themselves in the skin, such as thyroid disease,
right,
and vitamin deficiencies or vitamin excess, parasitic infestations.
How do parasites express themselves on the skin?
Usually they will express as itching or urticaria. Someone can have what is considered a hive of multiple hives that are ongoing, and occasionally we find that the person has intestinal parasites producing the problem.
I think we're getting a bit of interference on your phone line. Is that because we've split your line? Is that because you have both phones off the hook?
Yes, that's true.
Why don't we do this? Let's see, how are we going to do this? I'm not sure how the best thing to do. I mean, is it the case that Dr. Balin is sort of the expert on infectious disease? Should we just talk briefly about that with him and then get you, Dr. Pratt, back on to talk about the age-related stuff? Does that make sense?
Okay, that's fine.
Because we are getting some interference. We're getting sort of... All right, so let's go back to Dr. Balin for a moment. One of the things that I noticed is that there is also a real problem with things like drug interactions and skin problems. Like there was the scleroderma patient who eventually didn't respond to treatment, and finally you took her off of a blood pressure medication that had been known to cause scleroderma. Is a disease where the skin hardens and tightens, and it's very serious. But I noticed that you were not sure that you believed that it was the blood pressure medicine that made it better, going off of it, in other words. I'm still very impressed with how many pharmaceuticals are used in the treatment of the skin, and I can't help but think that it masks and contributes, because so many of the skin problems are also autoimmune in nature. A lot, like EMS, ENS, and various other skin-related diseases are autoimmune-related diseases. So, you there, Dr. Balin?
Yeah, well, I'm here. I mean, we certainly have a lot to learn, and you know, that's not just in the skin, but in all of medicine, and medicines themselves have many effects, and they have certain intended effects, and they have certain deleterious effects, and we don't know what they all are, and one has to just keep your eyes open and follow patients closely. And it's not always easy or cut and dry as people would hope it would be.
There are very serious skin ailments like psoriasis. And you talked about the different kinds of reasons this can arise in different types of treatments. You talk about many different skin-related problems, very serious ones, and how they can be treated. What I didn't hear you talk about is the relationship between skin disorders. Again, although you mentioned the relationship to autoimmune disease, I don't see you relating back to the issue of things like allergy responses and things like that. I mean, some people believe that, for instance, psoriasis may be arising because of food allergies and other types of allergic responses, which would make sense in lieu of the way in which these things seem to mimic autoimmune response, where the body is attacking tissues.
Well, I mean, we know that the immune system is of critical importance in almost all skin disease. The cells of the immune system elaborate growth factors that the skin uses to grow, and these white cells are all through the capillaries that are in the skin. In psoriasis, it's been found that part of the cause of psoriasis is the fact that white cells are pumping out growth factors, causing the skin to grow. Normally, from the time that a skin cell is born to the time that it is shed is a month. But in psoriasis, from the time it's born to the time it's shed, it's only 4 days. And that's because the cells are growing so fast. And the reason they're growing is because these immune system cells are pumping out these growth factors. Now, there's different things that cause the immune system cells to turn on and pump out the growth factors. And some of them can be related to responses to an antigen or a process which is called now superantigens. Superantigens are something where it seems like instead of having the immune system turned on very specifically, it seems to activate all of the immune system cells. Mm. And that happens in many forms of eczema. And so those are areas that we're constantly battling in skin disease.
So have you done any experimentations to see whether when people are treated for other immune response confusion, like allergies to foods and things like that, have you experimented with that? I mean, you're seeing that some people are reacting to pharmaceuticals and having an interaction and getting a problem, but have you experimented with other going down that road further? Since I know that one of your specialties also is that you're an internist as well.
Well, my specific area of research is to try to discover the cause of the aging process.
Uh-huh.
So I haven't experimented a lot on
autoimmune
diseases, okay. But I know a lot about the literature, and I, for example, in psoriasis, there's a whole group of individuals that believe psoriasis, at least in some people, is caused by an autoimmune response to some bacterial infestation or yeast infestation,
mm-hmm.
and they will treat their patients with a course of an antibiotic or a course of an anti-yeast medicine, and a certain percentage of people will get better.
Yeah.
And so it's likely that there are multiple causes that cause the immune system to turn out these growth factors. And in different people, some of them may be bacterial, some of them may be viral, some of them may be allergens, and other ones may just be intrinsic to them.
Right. Now, we have just a couple minutes before we go to break, but I know that you're doing, because of your research with aging, that you are involved in thinking about the way hormones in the skin interact, you know, like high estrogen and spidery veins and androgens, high male hormones and hair loss. And at one point, you discussed the possibility of using DHEA. And since you're doing research in aging, I'm wondering whether you've discovered anything new about DHEA that we should know about.
Well, I mean,
people are familiar with what it is, most of us that are listening here.
DHEA is a very interesting compound, and there's been exciting research, primarily done by a fellow named Arthur Schwartz, who discovered its ability to inhibit diabetes, to inhibit breast cancer, to prolong the life of laboratory animals. And so it's a very intriguing compound. We know that on the skin, DHEA causes the oil glands to redevelop and to produce more sebum. And in fact, there's a Dr. Ornstreich who patented DHEA used topically, but then never really used it much because he said whenever he used it on the skin, the people broke out in acne.
Right, right. And that has to do with the possible pathway toward testosterone. You know, we're going to have to stop for a moment. What I want to do is take a real brief break. I want to talk to the Balins for another 10 minutes or so before opening up the phone lines for your participation. We will be doing that at about 2:40. When we come back, I want to finish talking to Dr. Balin about DHEA, and then I want to talk to Dr. Pratt, his wife, about aging and some of the things that can be done after that damage has occurred. So this is your own health and fitness talk show. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman doing a show with the authors of The Life of the Skin. We're going to take a brief musical break, come back with a little more of the interview, and then we'll take your phone calls. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is your own health and fitness talk show. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman, doing a show with the authors of The Life of the Skin, Drs. Arthur Balin and his wife, Loretta Pratt Balin. We were talking about with Dr. Arthur Balin about DHEA a bit here, and I wanted to finish that off and then move on to talking about age-related damage for another 10 minutes or so, and then we'll open up the phone lines. Dr. Balin, So yeah, I mean, the tricky thing with DHEA is that although it has a precursor effect, we don't know which pathway it's going to go down. So I would say that it's very prudent for people probably to check their levels of DHEA before starting to swallow a bunch of it, huh?
Well, yeah, that's certainly true. And again, as far as anti-aging studies are concerned, from the again, Dr. Orntrag from the Kaiser Permanente, all the blood that they stored, he's measured the levels of DHEA in people over their lifespan, and these were all prospective studies, and it shows that the DHEA level goes down quite dramatically with age.
The only concern here is that people who are a little concerned about hormone replacement therapies, who are doing research in it, are aware of the fact that if you're not very careful with hormones after a certain age, that you may open yourself up for some forms of cancer. For instance, if DHEA goes to testosterone in men, although it doesn't seem to do that very much, it can increase their chances of getting prostate cancer. So, and in women, if it goes in the wrong direction, it can leave them open for too high an estrogen later in life, which may or may not be good. We don't know. So that's the dicey part. But are you telling me that in your research you're seeing dramatic effects on the skin with DHEA?
No, I'm saying that you have to be careful about using it on the skin because it'll break people out in acne.
Ah.
And as far as its use systemically in the body, it's a powerful drug, and we don't know the long-term effects. We're having an experiment which is being conducted now on the American people because it's been allowed to go over the counter, and we have animal studies, and now we're going to have human studies.
Yes.
Just because of people who are using it.
Yes. Anything that you want to leave us with in terms of the research you've been doing since you wrote the book about aging? Any little carrot you can hang out for us? Anything exciting?
Well, I think that there's, and Dr. Pratt will probably talk about this, but there's a lot that we can do for people's skin whose skin has been damaged by the sun and who has aged. And there are both topical medicines plus there's reconstructive surgery and all kinds of things that we can begin to set back aging of the skin.
But no new research about what we do with ourselves systemically from your research?
Boy, we don't. That's another show.
Ah, well, let me know if you want to schedule that, because that would be interesting. Let me know when you're ready for that. All right, well, let's get your wife back on the line, Dr. Loretta Pratt. One of the things that people, especially this type of listening audience, which tends to be a kind of natural, you know, people who like natural things and who feel comfortable with their face changing if it changes. One of the things that's surprising is that what I understand from reading your book is that when you repair age-damaged skin, it can actually protect you from getting future cancers. So explain that, because that really surprised me.
Well, when we do a procedure like laser skin resurfacing, where the outer layers of skin are removed, the new skin healing in is like brand new baby skin. It doesn't remember the damage that occurred before. And so, therefore, we really are removing the potential for skin cancer by removing the skin and allowing it to heal in again.
So part of what we're saying here is that, as I was trying to get to before, things like age spots are in the lower levels of the skin waiting to sort of reappear, that they represent damage that was done a long time ago. Am I understanding that right?
Yes, and we see that with ultraviolet photography. We can show up the underlying sun damage that has occurred, and people with more of those spots have had more skin damage from the sun, and people with less have been fairly protected. So there are ways that we can look at the skin and measure it, and also histologically looking at the skin under the microscope, we can see the skin damage.
And what we're looking at when we see all those brown spots and when we get freckly and things like that, what we're seeing there is an accumulation of these cells that produce melanin, yes?
Yes, it's...
They're overproducing in an unhealthy way, is that right?
Yes, and some of it is actually not the cells themselves, but the pigment production from the cells. And some spots are... Not all brown spots on the skin are the same, and so we really have to look out because... unless a trained eye is looking at these spots on the skin, they could all look the same, but there are differences between pigmented lesions on the skin, and some are moles, and some could be precancerous, leading to melanoma. Others can be what we call lentigos. There's also a cancerous form of the lentigo called lentigo maligna. So there are a lot of different pigmented lesions that occur in the skin, and some have the pigmented pigment-producing cells, melanocytes in them, and others are just pigment that is formed as a result of sun damage.
Yeah, I mean, What I basically got from reading this book was that I immediately made an appointment with a dermatologist to have them look at every piece of skin on my body to make sure that I didn't have any uneven-looking things that were changing. So apparently one of the most important things to do, no matter what you've done with your skin in the past, even if you've been protective, is to regularly have somebody look at you and make sure everything's staying the same.
Exactly. And I think all of the things that are lead to healthy bodies can lead to healthy skin. And, you know, making sure that in that we get enough calcium so we don't have bone loss, because the look of aging on the skin doesn't have to do only with the skin itself and sun damage, but also to other intrinsic aging processes like resorption of bone.
And so, free radical production.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm, from smoking and drinking and...
Right.
Right, and an unhealthy diet would do that as well. So free radical production, in fact, you've even said in your book that people who are, you can see it on their skin, whether their body is effectively handling free radicals or not.
Yeah.
What about, you know, we've talked about brown spots. In preparation for the show, several of my friends said, what about those little white spots? What about when you start getting little dots of white spots where there's no pigment, or little pink or red spots? What are those?
Well, the white spots are areas where the skin has been damaged and can no longer produce the pigment. So basically the pigment cells have been totally destroyed and you can no longer produce pigment in those sites.
So that means that they're vulnerable to the sun.
Yes, exactly.
Oh dear. Mm-hmm. What about little red ones?
Well, the little red spots, there are probably a few different kinds of little red ones. Sometimes we get red ones that we call cherry angioma, so they're that those little distinct cherry red spots. They are accumulation of blood vessels. They're little capillary proliferations, and we're not sure what causes them, but they do seem to increase as time goes on. And other little red spots or pink spots with a little scale on them could be squamous cell or basal cell skin cancer.
Okay, so the best thing is if you see changes in your skin, get checked, and in the meantime, start using SPF what? Should it change according, like I'm medium complected. Is a medium complected person, should I be running around in a 30, or should I be wearing a 15? How do you determine what kind of sunscreen to use?
Well, we recommend that everyone uses at least a 30, a 29 or higher.
What about the fact that some of the chemicals that they use are irritating to people's skin? Do you have recommendations for what kinds of products are less irritating?
Yes, there are some products that contain that they're called chemical-free, and they actually contain titanium dioxide, which is the white, pasty-looking substance that is in sunscreens. And those products tend to, you know, they're not translucent, so when you put them on the skin, they give the skin a whitish look because of the titanium dioxide. But those are probably the safest in terms of being chemical-free.
And strongest also, I guess I'm hearing, if you
yeah.
get an SPF. Okay. Once you've damaged your skin and you want to make some changes, partially protect you from future, you know, cancer growth, and also because maybe, as you say in the book, the face doesn't match the way the person feels, what I'm concerned with is not so much the laser resurfacing, because I've heard lots of good things about that. It's really quite non-invasive in terms of a surgery. It doesn't have a long healing time. You're not using an invasive, you're not using a lot of chemicals or anything. It's just resurfacing with lasers. But some of the other things like a chemical peel or dermabrasion, I can't help but think that if constant burning and peeling is dangerous to the skin as a child, why isn't dermabrasion and chemical peels? And chemicals, my gosh, are absorbed through the skin. So why aren't those long-term? Why aren't those dangerous?
Well, the dermabrasion doesn't involve chemicals. It's similar to the laser in that it's a destructive method. So you're actually physically removing the outer layers of skin. So that's
just very painful.
Yeah. But that doesn't have any long-term effects. In terms of chemical peels, there are some chemicals that are dangerous. Phenol peels can be quite dangerous and lead to heart problems and arrhythmias during the peeling process. And in general, we don't like to use those because the laser methods can replace that. Other chemicals like trichloroacetic acid or glycolic acid have very limited effects superficially. So they actually coagulate the top layer of skin, and then the reaction stops. We neutralize the acid formula with a base, and that stops the reaction also. So in general, most forms of peeling and mechanical forms of improving the skin are safe. The one to be the most cautious about would be the phenol.
Mm-hmm. And do we know, I noticed that you guys like using Retin A because it's a thing that people can use continuously to keep the skin, the cells changing. I mean, you can use at some weaker stuff like the exfoliants and things that are available, and some of them are available in natural forms, and we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks when we do a natural skin show. But I noticed that you like the Retin-A, and I'm wondering if we know about the long-term effects of Retin-A, whether it's going to be dangerous long-term down the road. Do we know? How long has it been in use?
Well, Retin-A was originally used for acne because it normalizes the cellular differentiation. It normalizes the rate at which cells shed from the skin, and it normalizes the oil production. So Retin-A has been used for acne for the last 25 to 30 years.
Oh, okay. So we do know that we do have a long-term use of it. Okay. And then what about things like collagen and people who have, may have some autoimmune problems in terms of reacting to the antigens in the collagen?
Yes, that is...
I'm talking about injected collagen, yeah.
Exactly. That is a matter of concern. And anyone with a history or family history of any autoimmune problems, including rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or dermatomyositis, should probably not receive collagen. And because it's thought that it may trigger these systemic diseases in people who are genetically prone.
Yeah, and there are some of us out there. Also, there's a new product on the market called Cell X, which is a vitamin C product. And that does something similar to Retin-A, does it not?
Well, the vitamin C it's an acid, obviously ascorbic acid, and it may have similar effects because of its low pH and similar to the alpha hydroxy acids, like glycolic acid, but it also is an antioxidant and works together with the other antioxidant vitamins like vitamin E to basically keep the skin healthier, fight free radicals. So I think why it's working in the skin and how it works, I think there have been limited studies, but I think it is promising.
One thing about Cell-X, all of these things, incidentally, if you use them, make your skin very vulnerable to the sun afterwards. So if you do any of these, you do have to really wear a hat and wear an enormous amount of sunblock, because you then, Dr. Raja said, you have like baby skin, so it's ultra sensitive to the sun after that, and your hands as well, because you're using it. Cell-X has tyrosine in it, and I have heard, and I don't know if you know whether or not this is true, that people who have thyroid disease are not supposed to take a lot of tyrosine. Do you know anything about this? Is there any reason not to use Cell-X for people who may have a problem with their thyroid? I'm asking because I hear so much from people who have thyroid problems.
Well, the amount that would be absorbed, especially when it's just applied to the limited area on the face, I would imagine would be safe. I don't know if... Dr. Balin has any thoughts on that?
I think that would be fine. I mean, we have plenty of tyrosine anytime you eat any food or meat or anything like that. And,
but of course it's in balance with others. But you're saying it's not that highly absorbed to the skin in this situation?
Right.
Well, and then I guess the last thing to say is that it looks to me as though maybe facelifts are a thing of the past. You know, that they're ultimately going to sort of fade out, especially because they need to be redone on a regular basis.
Yes, I think unless someone has, if you can pinch an inch or two, in front of your ear, I think that otherwise there are other methods of handling the aging changes in the skin.
You know, the last thing, too, was I was fascinated to discover that the reason that the skin sags on the face is because the skeletal structure is getting a little bit smaller, so that, in fact, doing facial exercises, a la Jack LaLanne taught us to do, is not a good idea.
That's right. The skeleton shrinks, so keeping our bones healthy and getting enough calcium throughout life will maintain our bony skeletal structure and cause less sagging of the skin, because we need that underlying bone to support our skin. And the facial exercises actually increase wrinkling in the skin because, if we just look at someone who smiles a lot or, smokes, any repeated facial movement will produce a wrinkle in that location.
And then, of course, just to remind people, smoking is absolutely devastating to the skin. It's the one thing that you just forget about your skin if you're going to, it's just very hard on the skin anyway.
Exactly.
All right, well, listen, the callers have been really patient, and I want to give them a chance to talk to you both. We're going to open up the lines now at 510-848-4425. Again, this is your own health and fitness talk show, and I'm health integration specialist speaking with the authors of the life of the skin. And we're opening up the phone lines right now at 510-848-4425 for you to participate with questions for Drs. Arthur Balin and Dr. Loretta Pratt Balin about the skin. So let's move on to a caller. Caller, you're on the air with KPFA. Go ahead, please.
Hello, am I on?
You sure are.
Okay. Yeah, I have a dermatitis condition. I have it on my hands, and I've had it on and off for many years. And I've gone to dermatologists, and they give me different ointments like triamcinolone. I can't know if I'm pronouncing these things right, or Lidex. And lately, I've been using some zinc oxide, which is just like roofing tar almost. You know, you can't put gloves on or anything. You have to just leave it on. But the thing that really bothers me about this dermatitis is the intolerable itching, usually at night. And the only way I can stop the itching is to put my hands under very, very hot running water. And I know that's not good for the skin, but that does stop the itching. I'm just wondering if there's anything that you can do to stop itching that is less destructive.
Yeah, this is going to be a little bit like trying to diagnose over the phone. Do either of you have any comments?
It sounds like you have a process called dyshidrotic eczema. It's a chronic problem.
Yes.
Itching is a big problem. There are anti-itching pills that your doctor can give you. The hot water is not bad if you don't allow your skin then to dry out. If after you run the hot water on your skin, you put Vaseline or something to keep the skin hydrated.
Yeah, that's what I do. And then when I put the ointment on my hand or the Vaseline, then I put these gloves on.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's a good idea or not, though, because sometimes the gloves can kind of dry out the skin, too, because, you know...
If the skin stays hydrated, that's okay. But it is a tough problem. There's no question about it.
Yeah. And have you ever had tests to see if there's any allergy, anything that you're coming in contact with?
Oh, I know I have allergies, yeah. This is contact dermatitis.
Okay, so that sounds like it needs to be pursued a little further, but I want to thank you for your call. I'm sorry to cut you off, it's just that we've got a lot of lines flashing. So thank you for that call. It sounds like that needs to be investigated a little further.
Yeah, maybe something simple he touches every day.
That's often what it is.
That he could eliminate. Yeah.
Let's get another caller on. Caller, you're on the air with your own health and fitness.
Has either one of the doctors heard of something called Curaderm by Dr. Chan in Australia?
Either one of you heard of Cura? What is it?
Curaderm.
Curaderm. Doesn't sound like it.
No, I haven't heard of that.
No, they haven't heard of it. Okay,
thank you.
Uh-huh. Let's try someone else. Caller, go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Yeah, I want to make a comment and a question. The comment has to do with how people use this information in terms of the balance of our potential responses for considering the sunlight as being dangerous. Really strikes me as leading people astray if we have to go out constantly avoiding sun, being fearful of sun, wearing large hats, and avoiding the obvious source of something that's a profound source of pleasure and nutrients. And in regards to that balance, it's a bit like David Sobel and Robert Ornstein in their book Healthy Pleasures pointed out that we have to look always for the balance in terms of fats and cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
If we go too extreme to lowering our cholesterol, we find it's actually unhealthy.
Right.
And I don't know what happens if people go to the point of being fearful of sun and avoiding that, losing the pleasure and the relaxation and the enjoyment.
Right.
What really is the balance of our health?
Right. Well, I think you know what I heard Dr. Balin saying is not to do that, but to take prudent about it, depending on your skin tone, too.
Right, but there's a lot of fear that I think people might be feeling. The fact
yes.
is that most skin cancers, 90% of them, are not the melanomas that are decidedly deadly and worrisome, and we need both to watch ourselves and to get professional help when needed. The
mm-hmm.
others are virtually always curable and helped. And likewise, the idea that every person should go every year to a dermatologist, we can't frankly afford that, let alone could the dermatologist, if everybody do that, see them. Because there's a certain degree of balance.
Okay.
There.
You know what, we've got a lot of callers,
right.
So give
I
me
have
a question
I
real
have
quickly.
A question, and that has to do with the skin as an emotional organ. Would and I appreciate the scholarship in the other areas, would there be some comment on that? Because it's been my experience as a physician that the skin expresses and often can be helped by looking at underlying emotional problems,
okay,
particularly in the area of atopic dermatitis, hives.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. Let's let them respond. Thank you very much for your sense of balance and bringing up those issues. Go ahead, please, Dr. Balin, or either of you.
I would just say first that you're absolutely right that we don't say we don't want people to be fearful of the sun. We want people to be prudent. The chance of a person getting melanoma in 1935 was 1 in 1,500 people. The chance in the year 2000 is 1 in 87 people. So it is a big increase, and we do have to pay attention to it.
Yeah, there has been a change in the ozone layer.
I do think that we do have the resources to have people examined by dermatologists. It's unfortunate. It would be fine if they were seen by their family doctor and their doctor could look at their skin. That would be great too. But
yes, I agree. I think we do have the resources for everyone to have a complete skin examination once a year, and to say that that isn't possible, I think is not true.
Now, you guys do have a section in the book where you talk about the skin as an emotional organ, so maybe you should respond to that as well.
Well, the skin is the largest sensory organ, certainly, and it's also really a mind-body connection. It's really the switchboard for the mind-body connection. And stress and emotional factors do manifest themselves in the skin. And in other ways, stimulating the skin and through massage therapy and acupuncture and all those ways can lead to in the opposite direction to health. So I think there's a great mind-body connection through the skin.
And it goes back to what the caller was trying to talk about, which is a sense of balance so that you're not walking around in a state of fear in your skin, literally. Let's get some more callers on. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling about psoriasis. I've had psoriasis for about 4 years. My father had psoriasis. I've read Edgar Cayce's approach to healing psoriasis. I've tried Ayurvedic approach to psoriasis. I haven't tried anything pharmaceutical or Western, but no matter what I do, there still are phases in my during the year where it will really come out. And I've heard that exposure to the sun can help heal psoriasis. And I was just wondering if either doctor had any more comments on psoriasis and any luck they've had with healing it.
Thank you for that call. It's a very important question.
Well, I mean, psoriasis, patients with psoriasis is the one, one of the cases. But we use sunlight to treat many different skin diseases because of its effect on the immune system and other cells. And in psoriasis, sunlight is a very effective treatment for psoriasis. And for some reason, patients that have psoriasis and get a lot of sun tend not to get a lot of skin cancers, even though they get a lot of sun exposure. So I would, living in California, I would encourage that.
So it's a little confusing, isn't it? This whether we do the sun or not do the sun is a little confusing.
Well, it's not that confusing, but it's like everything in life is a balance. And with all medicines, because they have deleterious effects, you have to say that the benefit of using that is going to outweigh its potential disadvantage.
Yeah.
In fact, if a person with psoriasis gets too much sun and they get a sunburn, that can actually make the psoriasis worse through a phenomenon called the Kevlarization. Where if patients get an injury to the skin, and that injury could be a laceration or a burn, and if they get a sunburn in areas of their skin, psoriasis will actually get worse in those areas. So the balance is quite important.
Yeah, and it's a hard one for people. Balance is difficult, but you're right, it is balance, and it is getting an education, too, and reading about stuff. And I do think your book goes a long way to educate people. I think, do we have time for one more very, very quick call? Let's take one more quick one. Caller, can you go ahead, please? We do need it to be quick.
Yes, I have a friend who has very hot feet so that she can't wear shoes, has to have ice put on her feet all the time. And it may be an autoimmune disease. I wonder if you have any insight about this.
Thanks for the call. Go ahead. Hello?
Yeah.
Dr. Balin?
Well, I mean, I guess to try to explore that process, I don't have any...
I think we have seen at least one or two cases like that in our careers. And
maybe a vascular process.
Yes. Combination of things that should be checked out, huh?
Yeah,
sounds like
including,
it.
You know, getting an autoimmune workup, including...
Yeah, I was going to say maybe an internist would be the best first place to go with this. All right, well, listen, we're really out of time, and I want to thank you both. I do like this book. I do encourage people to read it because it's extremely educational. Whether you decide, you know, in other words, I think the best solution to all of this is to get educated, and there's some very good scientific information in this book. It's called The Life of the Skin, What It Hides, What It Reveals, and How It Communicates. And we've been talking to Arthur Balin, MD, PhD, and Loretta Pratt Balin, MD, and you've both been very generous with your time. I want to thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Yep. Next week, you know what, I'm going to come back with another skin show, only this one will be all about natural skin care. So those of you who felt that this show was emphasizing allopathic too much will be relieved, because in 2 weeks we'll be doing a show on natural skin care, and we can talk about the balance of it. Again, I want to thank those of you who called, and remind you that if you want to get a copy of today's show or some other shows in this series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call me during normal business hours, 707-769-1458. You can, and again, that's 707-769-1458. You can also send me a business-sized envelope, self-addressed stamped envelope, to P.O. Box 2714, Petaluma, 94953. And come back next week for a solo show. It's going to be the best of Your Own Health and Fitness. It's an old solo show called The Art of Self-Care. And then the following week, I'll be back live with a second skin show with Joni Lagram, author of the Natural Skincare book, and we'll be exploring the more holistic methods of skincare. I'm Lena Berman. This has been Your Own Health and Fitness on KPFA 94.1 FM. Please play your pledges. See you in a couple weeks.